anti-Israel campus rallies in protest at the regime's genocide in Gaza, arresting hundreds of protesters. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. More than 200 days into Israel's genocide in Gaza, Palestinians continue to fall victim to the regime's indiscriminate airstrikes and artillery fire across the besieged strip. Palestinian journalist Muhammad Bassam al-Jamal has been killed along with his family members in an attack on their house in the city of Rafah. His death brings 139 the number of journalists killed in the Gaza war. A separate attack targeting a highway in central Gaza left at least 8 Palestinians dead. Dozens of people are also killed and injured in strikes on several other locations, including the Al Zaytun neighborhood in the southeast, the Shati refugee camp, and the Nasser neighborhood in the west, and Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. The death toll from the Israeli war on Gaza has now surpassed 34,300, including 14,000 children. Over 77,000 people have also been injured, while thousands more remain unaccounted for. There is no end in sight to Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces have carried out an incursion into the city of Ramallah. A 16-year-old boy was killed after they fired live rounds on a group of Palestinians. The regime has intensified its raids and attacks across the occupied territory since launching a genocidal war on Gaza in October. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for more details.
It's obvious now that every time the Israeli forces storm Palestinian areas, villages, towns, cities, the Israeli soldiers use their guns, even if there are no threats against them from the Palestinians. This time, Israeli soldiers raided the city of Ramallah, stormed Attiri area, stormed old town of Ramallah, as well as the Umm Sharayit neighborhood, in order to arrest Palestinians. This is what the Israeli military continue to justify the raiding of Palestinian areas. During the military raid of Ramallah, Israeli soldiers opened fire at Palestinians who went to the streets in order to prevent any Israeli aggression against the people. During the military raid, forces opened fire, shot and killed 16-year-old Khalid Arkawi. Khalid Arkawi from Jenin city, and the Palestinians in Jenin city and refugee camp mourned Khalid Arkawi, and they were expecting his body to be transferred from Ramallah to Jenin in order to be buried there.
The Israeli military has carried out yet another attack on eastern Lebanon as tensions flare up between the regime and the Hezbollah resistance movement over Gaza. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier from the Lebanese capital Beirut with more details.
Yes, we have seen that the Israeli army has launched several attacks against the eastern parts of the country, but now we are talking about an attack that is very close to the city of Baalbek itself. We also know that it targeted an area, or perhaps the drone attack missed the truck which was containing fuel. And so that was very close, a very close call, actually. The targeting of this truck could have ended or resulted in a huge, massive explosion, which could have led to a lot of casualties. Fortunately, it seemed that the rocket had hit somewhat of a sandy area, or the sides of the road, instead of hitting the truck directly, and that only led to maybe some wounds. And we have the driver has sustained some wounds. So fortunately, it was a close call. But this is considered definitely a violation of what we are looking at as rules of engagement, or the rules that are put forth of this war that is taking place between Hezbollah and Israel. We notice how Hezbollah is consistently retaliating based on the Israeli aggression. Once the Israelis, of course, attack civilians, Hezbollah then retaliates by using Katyusha rockets, by using Glad rockets. Hezbollah has made it clear in many of their operations that they are directly targeting Israeli soldiers. Hezbollah has said in the last 200 days of combat, we have seen casualties among the Israelis, although it is not very evident. The Israelis are not admitting to it, but Hezbollah are estimating the number of Israeli soldiers either killed or wounded to 2,000. And so this is a very big number.
Germany has withdrawn a warship from the Red Sea following the failure of an EU military mission to confront Yemen's maritime campaign in support of the Gaza Strip. The frigate had been deployed in the strategic waterway in February in the face of pro-Palestine operations by the Yemeni armed forces. Abdul Latif al-Moshali reports from Sana'a.
Its mission alongside an American and British coalition. This coalition aimed to safeguard Israeli navigation amidst Yemeni forces imposing a stifling blockade on Israeli maritime traffic.
A bigger war was looming large after the appearance of Western fleets in the Red Sea. The vision has now become clear after the operations of the Yemeni army and Ansarullah against Israeli ships. Certainly, there is another tactic, vision, and attempts to find solutions after the Western failure to stop the Yemeni attacks. The withdrawal is not a radical withdrawal and may be a strategic change in Western plans in the Red Sea.
While some military experts speculate that this German departure may indicate repositioning and preparation for a major regional war, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs welcomed the withdrawal, underscoring Sana'a's primary concern for the safety of international maritime navigation. He urged the world to treat Yemen with respect to safeguard their interests.
The departure of the German frigate from the Yemeni coast is the beginning of the departure of many ships, despite American pressure on countries to join the U.S. operations in the Red Sea. In fact, the Yemeni army possesses weapons carrying new surprises that will force all Western ships to leave. We are prepared for any scenario that the West is planning, whether returning to a broader war or otherwise. Our siege on Israel will continue and will not stop unless the aggressive war on Gaza stops.
Germany's FGS Hessen becomes the fourth warship to depart from the Red Sea since the inception of the European Union's naval mission Aspides, which alongside the US-led coalition has failed to protect Israeli-affiliated vessels from Yemeni attacks supporting Palestinian resistance.
With Yemen's armed forces having successfully attacked over 100 vessels linked to Israel, observers speculate that recent Western actions may indicate preparation for a new phase of confrontation with Yemeni forces. However, Sana'a has reiterated that Yemen's pro-Palestinian naval operations will persist until the Israeli war on Gaza comes to an end.
U.S. police have arrested nearly 100 pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Southern California as campus demonstrations continue to spread across the country. American students from California to Massachusetts hold sit-ins in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The protesters call for a ceasefire in the besieged strip and an end to the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Some of them chant slogans such as, Jews want the end of the war. On many campuses, the students have set up tents to press their demands. They're also calling on U.S. universities to divest from companies with ties to Israel. Hundreds of students and others have been arrested at Columbia, Yale, and New York University since Friday. Pro-Palestine protests have been held in numerous other universities in Texas, Ohio, California, New York, and Michigan. American students continue their peaceful sit-ins on university campuses in protest of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and the U.S. government's support for the Tel Aviv regime. Let's take a listen to some of the students who keep protesting despite police crackdown on the rallies.
The goal, I think, was to start an encampment, but earlier this morning they were accosted by police officers. Apparently they were told to come and ruin their encampment that they were starting to build. Anyone who will stay on the grass will be arrested, and so there are people who decided to stay. They're all interlinked in the center.
As a African-American person, I understand what it is to have your rights taken away. Not at the scale of Palestinians, but I understand what it means to have your rights taken away or to be treated badly. This was a quiet protest. We did not hurt anyone, hit anybody, start any riots. So basically, it was a protest that was very civil, and they came and started hitting people and started arresting people.
Russia has warned that it will target NATO's nuclear weapons if the Western military alliance deploys them in Poland. We discussed the issue in our news review program and stick us into what our guests had to say about that. It's a news review where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Moscow has warned NATO against deploying nuclear warheads in Poland after Warsaw officials said they would welcome such a move by the Western military alliance. The Russian deputy foreign minister said NATO nuclear weapons in Poland will be on the military target if deployed there. Sergei Ryabkov also called the potential deployment a threat to Russia's national security. On Monday, the Polish president said Warsaw is ready to host nuclear arms if NATO decides, in the face of Russia's reinforcing its armaments in Belarus and Kaliningrad. In June 2023, Russian President Vladimir Putin confirmed that Russia had sent tactical nuclear arms to Belarus, which borders Ukraine and Poland. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Samuel Geddes joining us from Melbourne. Also, we have journalist Dmitry Zolotarev joining us from Irkutsk, Russia. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Geddes and give us your perspective on this warning coming from Moscow against NATO deploying nuclear warheads in Poland.
Well, I don't think the statement in and of itself is particularly new or surprising. What I think is more significant is that this comes right on the heels of the $95 billion aid package just signed off by the American Congress, as I'm sure you know, most of which is earmarked for weapons transfers to Ukraine. This really seems to just underline the fact that the United States, as in Gaza, has no interest, or certainly does not display any interest in de-escalation, as in with regards to Ukraine, of trying to find some kind of diplomatic settlement to the conflict. Rather, it is continuing to fuel it at the cost of thousands of Ukrainian and Russian lives. So in that context, it doesn't seem particularly surprising that Russia would issue such a warning. The US and NATO in particular have an enormous amount of leverage, if they wanted to use it, to try and bring the Ukraine conflict to an end, that leverage being their military support, massive military support to Ukraine. But they are evidently uninterested in using that leverage to end the war. They're choosing to use it to continue it.
Mr. Zolotarev, I want to get your perspective on the issue as well. Do you think it would be a wise move for NATO to deploy nuclear warheads in Warsaw?
It absolutely would be if they seek a suicide. Yeah, sure, why not? They don't blow smoke, they don't waste words. So if Russia promises something, it's pretty likely to keep it. So, you see, our things to me, like, you know, a couple of idiots who just listening to the teacher of chemistry, don't mix these chemicals. They sneak into the chemistry class and just to see what happens, mix them. One, it goes off or produces poisonous gas and they die. That's what happens. So that's what NATO tries to do with Poland. They know that the war in Ukraine is coming to an end. It's inevitable. And Russia is going to win. They know that. So I think they try to create ground for another conflict. It just proves that no one matters to them. Neither Ukraine, neither Poland, neither Baltic states, neither anybody. They're just using them. That's what I see in it. And, well, yes, if Russia sees NATO's nuclear weapons just next to its borders, Russia is pretty likely to destroy it with conventional weapon, not using nuclear weapon.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. Thanks to journalist and political commentator Samuel Geddes joining us from Melbourne, and thanks to Mr. Dmitry Zolotarev speaking to us from Irkutsk, Russia. Moving on, the Afghan population is facing severe food insecurity, putting them one step away from famine. As the situation nears a critical point, Afghans are already struggling to secure their basic needs for survival. Rahmatullah Baghwan reports from Kabul.
A recent United Nations report predicts that approximately 16 million individuals in Afghanistan will be struggling to gain access to food this year. To get a better understanding of the situation, we visited a family in Kabul facing acute food shortages. The Rukhsana family's daily struggle mirrors the difficulties faced by countless households across the country.
I lost my husband during the war in our hometown. I don't have a male provider and I can't find a source of income. One of my grandkids polishes boots, but that is not enough for our family. It has been a long time since the last time we had rice and potatoes in our home. We barely eat two meals a day, which is stale breads and tea. My children are asking for soup and I feel so bad as I can't make it for them.
Our situation here is so difficult that we can hardly survive. It is because there is no income or food to eat. If we eat during the day, we should sleep with empty stomachs at night. There are people who skip meals to feed their children. Some families beg for food but fail to find some because almost no one has a better situation. We used to receive some aid from the United Nations World Food Program, but now it is gone and has left people to their fate.
According to the UN report, the Afghan population cannot fulfill essential needs, including health care, food, employment, and shelter. Some local experts argue that the current hardships faced by Afghans stem from prolonged foreign interventions and conflicts, suggesting that those involved bear a responsibility to aid in the crisis resolution.
I think all the misery and economic hardships that Afghans are going through today stem from the shameful U.S.-West intervention and wars in Afghanistan. If they had let us build constructive economic relations with our neighbors, we would not be so broken today. The U.S. and its allies are responsible because they came and destroyed our infrastructure here, and on the other hand, they imposed economic sanctions after their withdrawal. Today, they cannot turn a blind eye on what they have created.
As the international community's attention shifts away from Afghanistan and the foreign aid continues to shrink, the Afghan people still hope for a means of survival that will pull them back from the edge of crisis. Millions of Afghans are facing emergency levels of food insecurity and malnutrition. The UN agencies warn that the situation is expected to worsen rapidly if urgent action are not taken by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghwan, Kabul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
hidden files. But it's hard to believe that we are still witnessing this Zionist Holocaust take place against the Palestinians in Gaza. How is it possible that 4% of the population in Gaza has been killed or injured? How is it possible that this is still going on? What happened to the leaders of the world? What happened to international law? These are questions that many people have been asking since the start of this genocide. Well, I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. And today we'll be talking to someone who has spent most of his life working in the field of international law and working with various international human rights organizations. Perhaps he can shed some light on the reasons we are still watching genocide in real time without it being forced to be stopped. But before we talk to our guests, let's take a look at this example of an Orwellian realm of doublethink that we recently saw from U.S. President Joe Biden, which is the root of the problem we're facing in countering this genocide.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and you cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas. It's like the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a work captain. I said, look, don't make the mistake.
Well, as mind-boggling as that is, it is the reality coming out of Washington when dealing with the Israeli regime. Well, I'd like to bring in our guest now who may be able to explain to us how we got here and why has international law failed the people of Palestine.
Alfred Morris de Zayas is an American lawyer, writer, historian, and expert in the field of human rights and international law, a retired high-ranking United Nations official, a peace activist, and since 2012, the United Nations independent expert on the promotion of democratic and equitable international order, also known as Special Rapporteur, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. He is a retired senior lawyer with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former Secretary of the Human Rights Committee and Chief of the Petitions Section.
Well, welcome to Hidden Files, Alfred Maurice de Zayas. With your experience, perhaps you can explain to us what is happening and why we're seeing this total breakdown in international law. I mean, from a strictly legal sense, which international laws would you say have been violated in Gaza since October, and how would you define these crimes?
Well, the International Court of Justice already, back in 2004, had the opportunity to examine the practice and the legislation in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And they determined that there were serious violations of the international human rights regime. That entails the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Then they also went into international humanitarian law and actions that Israel has done, collective punishment, destruction of private property in occupied territory, etc., which all violates the Hague Conventions of 1907 and, of course, the Geneva Conventions of 1949, and the 1977 protocols. Now, at that time, When we talk about the Gaza war, one of the problems that I detect in the media, primarily the narrative of the mainstream media, is that they focus on the 7th of October, 2023, as if the war had started in 2023, whereas obviously the conflict goes back to the mandate that the Brits had over Palestine, and the Nakba, the catastrophe that fell upon the Palestinians when the Israelis waged war on them in 1947-48, expelled a million of them, devastated their houses and their olive orchards, etc., etc. And ever since 1947-48, it's been an ongoing war against the Palestinians, and always occupation, occupation of Palestinian territory, denial of the right of the Palestinians of self-determination.
Well, based on what you said and the various sightings that you've just discussed, Israel is an occupation force and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and fight the occupiers. But the reality seems to be something else.
Well, that is the problem with international law, because international law is not self-executing. The International Court of Justice cannot enforce its judgment. It depends on the good faith and the goodwill of the states parties to the statute of the ICJ. And of course, the rulings of the Security Council, say take Resolution 242 of 1967, that was after the Six-Day War. Israel is ordered by the Security Council to withdraw its army, never did. So this is something that goes back nearly 60 years of daily violation of Security Council Resolution 242. When a Security Council resolution is violated, then what usually would happen is that you would have a follow-up resolution imposing sanctions under Article 41. But that's impossible because the United States blocks it. Now, one of the most atrocious abuses of the veto power by the United States, you have just seen it over the last weeks, the United States has blocked not one, but three Security Council resolutions demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. What does that tell you? Considering that a case is pending before the International Court of Justice, considering that on the 26th of January, the International Court of Justice decided not only that it had jurisdiction, but that there was a plausible case of genocide in progress, thereby justifying the issuance of an order, what is called provisional measures. So the International Court of Justice adopts a rather comprehensive list of orders to Israel, which Israel has violated, has completely ignored. So that adds insult to injury.
Well, you've researched about the rights of minorities throughout the world. I mean, is there anything comparable to the Palestinian case in your perspective?
Well, you have to go a bit further back in history. We Europeans and Americans have a legacy of colonialism and imperialism. And when the Brits came to North America, there used to be 10 million indigenous in North America. And by the end of the 19th century, there were only 200,000 left. So more than 90% of the indigenous were wiped out. People tried to excuse it and say, oh, well, they all got sick because of European diseases. No doubt, smallpox and other European diseases probably killed as many as 50% of the indigenous population. But the rest of the 50% were wiped out deliberately by the U.S. forces that kept pushing them further and further west, slaughtered their buffalo, burnt their crops, burnt their villages, slaughtered the civilians. You have so many. Wounded Knee is one of many, many massacres. And people have written quite a bit about the Wounded Knee. As the case may be, that is an example of the deliberate genocide committed by the American governments, a whole series of American governments, under the banner of manifest destiny. So our destiny was to conquer the entire territory, except that according to, you know, the doctrine of discovery, you can only discover territory that is terra nullius, territory that doesn't belong to anybody. But when you come to a territory where 10 million people are already settled and they have cities and villages and irrigation and all sorts of things, and what do? You wipe them out because you want the territory, but you don't want the people. You're so racist that you don't want to incorporate the indigenous population into your society. So, first of all, you push them out. You expel them, and you make treaties with them. They trust you, and then you break all the treaties, one right after the other. So, on occasion, the indigenous decided they're going to fight back. And since they were so comparatively weak militarily, they were then crushed by the military power of the United States. Now, Martin Luther King Jr., everybody knows him, respects him, etc. Everybody pays tribute to him. But how about reading what he actually said in his book, Why We Can't Wait, published in 1964, page 141. Martin Luther King writes, our country was born in genocide. And then he goes on, not to talk about slavery, not to talk about segregation and what the Afro-Americans had to endure. He talks about the extermination of the Algonquins and the Crees and the Cherokees and the Navajos and the Dakotas and Lakotas and Sioux and Hopi, etc., etc. And he complains that because of the, shall we say, narrative that we get in history books, this conquest of the Golden West is a success story. Of course, for the whites. I mean, we stole the entire continent and we massacred the population. And he says, as an Afro-American, this is a disgrace. What kind of morals do we have? Are we at all a Christian country? Do we have a moral compass?
Well, thanks so much. Stay with me, Alfred. We'll be right back right after this. Well, thanks so much for staying with me, Alfred. Continuing our discussion, you know, in your previous books, You've explained that genocides generally occur with the knowledge of a small number of people. Do you see an analogy with Palestine today, given the comparative silence of Western politicians and media bias?
Well, take the Holocaust. The Nazis bent over backwards to hide what they were doing. I mean, they did not have Auschwitz and Majdanek and Sobibor in Frankfurt or in Hamburg or in Berlin. They had it out in Poland and in Ukraine so that the population would not find out about it. And there were rumors, and as soon as there were rumors, they were denied. And those who were spreading the rumors landed themselves in concentration camps. Because people seem to forget that Dachau was opened not for Jews. Dachau was opened to imprison first the communists, then the socialists, anybody who did not bend to the will of Hitler. And there were plenty of Germans who were not bending to his will. They landed in Buchenwald, they landed in Bergen-Belsen, etc., which were not per se extermination camps. The six extermination camps were all in the east. I mean, Treblinka and Lublin, Majdanek, etc., etc. So that the Germans knew that what they were doing was criminal. What's amazing in comparison to what's going on in Gaza is that it's so public. You can watch it on television. You can click on your internet and you have all of these horrendous pictures of hospitals and schools and UN shelters. We have lost a couple of hundred of UN staffers, victims of the indiscriminate bombardment by Israel. And then there is a mainstream narrative that tells you that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, is very careful not to hurt civilians, that they only target military objectives, and if they kill civilians, this is collateral damage, it's not intended.
Right, but the Israeli regime itself, I mean, has no qualms about publicly commenting about their genocide, whether it's saying that we're going to wipe them out or Amalek. You talked about the Nazis and trying to hide what they had done, but the Israelis don't try to hide it. Your thoughts about this?
That has a psychological explanation. We Americans, we are educated from very small, in grammar school, in primary, in secondary school, that we are, by definition, the good guys, which of course means that everybody else is the bad guy. So we are educated to believe that we are special, that we are exceptional, that we are the indispensable people. And then you have the phenomenon that you're so convinced, you're such a solipsist, me and me and me, that you fear whatever rival there is. So instead of educating the American people or the Israeli people, or for that matter the French or the Germans, etc., that we're the same as everybody else, that we're all children of God, and that we all share this one little planet of ours, and that we have to live together, instead of teaching that, we are taught to fear. There is a culture of fear inculcated in every student, in every pupil, whether it be the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Israel. I mean, we are by definition the good ones, and the others are threatening us. So you play with the emotions of the population, and remarkably enough, the masses believe it. That is our problem. The capacity of self-deception of the population is very, very great, and the faculty of self-criticism is totally underdeveloped. You have, of course, brilliant professors, John Mearsheimer, Jeffrey Sachs, Francis Boyle, Richard Falk, Stephen Kinzer, Dan Kovalik, who see very clearly what's going on, and they write very clearly about it. But do they come in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in CNN? Hardly. The New York Times and Washington Post, for instance, never wants to hear my point of view. And when I send them op-ed articles, they never publish them because I'm not singing the song that they want to hear. Right. So I don't exist. And some of these great scholars, even including Noam Chomsky, are shoved aside because their analysis doesn't fit the agendas of our military, industrial, financial, digital complex. So everything actually revolves around money. The military, industrial complex needs war if it wants to make money. We need to sell arms. And only sell arms if the arms are destroyed in war. You can't sell a new tank if they have an army with several tank battalions and the tanks are still intact, so you can't sell them anymore. So you have to make sure that there's a war so that these tanks, so the Leopard tanks and the Abrams tanks, are destroyed, so you sell a couple more. Same thing with planes, same thing with missiles, same thing with drones. So the whole thing is a financial scam. It's a way of a perpetuum mobile, of constantly feeding wars. How do we do that? Through propaganda. We do that through instilling in the population this fear that justifies ever higher military budgets.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RAB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RAB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. We have been speaking about our brothers in faith and their rights over us and what we must do that for them, and making sure that their rights are met. Even when it comes to greeting them and being happy with them, this is something all the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam have mentioned. Now, we live in the technology age, which we don't do what we used to do back in the day. We used to write letters to one another. Now, alhamdulillah, we started with emails, but now no one uses emails anymore, so we're just basically texting, whether on social media platforms or just straightforward SMS. That writing to our brothers in faith and asking about them, actually something that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam have spoken about. Imam Mustaraq salamullah alayhi says in a hadith, you need to visit them wherever you are, wherever you might be doing. And he says, even when they are in Safar, so when they are present, you just go visit them. If you want to connect with them while they are in the travel, he says, by writing a letter. Now, it could be a phone call, it could be a text message, it could be an SMS, you know, one of the social media. You can reach your brothers and your sisters in faith and, you know, keep in contact with them and stay with them. Also, we have a hadith from the Imam Ja'far Sadiq salamullah alayhi when he talks about not asking the believer too much, because sometimes we ask too much of believers. He says, لا تسألوا أخوانكم الحوائج فيمنعوكم فتغضبون وتكفرون. He says, don't ask your brother too much, because sometimes you might ask him a question and what happens is that that brother will say no to you. No, maybe because he doesn't have what you're asking for, or sometimes he just doesn't want to give it to you. It's his choice, his right. And if he does that, they will deprive you of that. Obviously, you're going to get angry. Oh, dude, why can't you let me lend your car? Well, obviously, it's sentimental to him. But he gets angry that, well, he's not giving me his car. And what happens is that you get angry. And anger, the Imam says, leads to kufr, leads to disobedience in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Also, on the other hand, we have been advised to also ask our brothers and sisters in faith. So the Imam says, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, when it comes to your brother Muslim, love for him what you love for yourself, and hate for him what you hate for yourself. Now, the Imam is talking about a brotherhood where everything is so smooth between one another that there's no problems. That if he asks you for something, you give it to him. If you ask for something, he will give it to you. Not that type of the brothers that would deprive you. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. So we said, when it comes to brothers, first try not to ask if you have to ask because of a need. Obviously, that is something that we should equalize and knowing who to ask from, because some people just don't have the capacity. If they don't and they reject us, what happened will is that we're going to get angry. We might say haram stuff. We might backbite them and so on and so forth. The Imam says what might lead to kufr and committing kufr in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Another thing that we need to do for our brothers and sisters in faith is to accept their, as we say it, excuses. Now, you invite someone over for lunch or dinner, or you ask someone to do something for you, but they, you know, they give you an excuse that they can't make it, and you might get the hint that it feels like an excuse. What do I do here? Al-Imam As-Sadiq Salamullah Alayhi, he says, when you ask a believer for a thing, then prepare excuses for him yourself before he gives you one. And now the Imam Salamullah Alayhi is going a level higher here. He's like, you're going to ask your brother for something. There's a big chance that he might say no. And because that chance that he might reject or say no, you prepare a reason to why he's saying that, a valid reason to convince yourself why he said that before he does it. And if he becomes, if he gives you a valid reason and if he asks you for an apology, then accept it. Whatever excuse he gives, accept it. Even though when you doubt or you have a high, let's say, probability in your mind that he is lying or saying something that is not true or against reality, the Imam says, still go with it. Don't tell him you're a liar. Don't tell him, I think you're trying to fool me or you're not giving it to me. I know you have it, this and that. No, no, no. If he says, I can't give it to you, accept it. Say to him, okay, thank you very much. And you walk away. And that leads to having trust in the believers with one another. They start to trust one another. And Imam Salamullah Alayhi, he says, this is a story of the Imam Salamullah Alayhi, where a person coming to the Imam and they trying to do a business where they send it to Yemen. The Imam says, he asked the person that he wants to send goods with a person to another place. So this person said to the Imam, oh, Imam, did you know that this person drinks alcohol? And the Imam said, so when a person comes and tells you something about a person and all the believers believe so, then the Imam says, then believe him, you have no reason not to go against him or call him a liar. And show him your love. The Prophet said, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam says, when one of you love his other brother, let him say it to him. Tell them that you love them. What's the harm in that? Because the more we show affection towards each other, the stronger we are, the more firm we are. The more we show affection towards one another in terms of verbal affection, physical affection, in terms of shaking hands and hugging, this is all enforces the believers. It makes them stronger. So this is not something to be ashamed of. No. By all means, express your love towards your brother, express your emotions towards your brother, and tell him how valuable he is to you. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of truth, hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.